Everyone, welcome back to another episode of the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is
Bill Hanks.
Corey Bob.
I'm Corey Knockreiner.
On today's episode, we have a few different news topics we want to cover. So with that, let's go ahead and
crawl right in.
So we have quite a few different news stories to hop through today. Let's go ahead.
We're hopping through. It's better than diving.
Why do I feel like no matter what verb I use?
It's just so fun for me. I like to make you break out that thesaurus, Mark.
Next week, we're just going to talk about the news. That's all we'll do.
No, I don't know. Maybe I have diving. Some more hot one thematic episodes for you, and we'll be crawling into the news.
Pass. Anyways, let's start with our first news story, which is a bit of a continuation on a trend that we've kind of talked about over the last 2 years or so now. A South Korean cryptocurrency exchange called Upbit just disclosed an unknown attacker managed to steal 342,000 Ethereum crypto coins from their exchange's hot wallet, transferring them into funds under a wallet under the attacker's control. At the time, this is valued at around $50 million worth of Ethereum.
Boom.
Which is insane. As of yet, the funds are still in the attacker's wallet at the time we're recording this. Upbit says that they will pay to fund the replacement of the stolen Ethereum so that none of their customers are affected.
It's pretty big for $50
million. That's a ton of money. And that they have now transferred all of their cryptocurrency kept in their hot wallets into cold wallets for safer keeping. So you actually kind of pointed at the first thing I want to talk about. $50 million is a lot of money, and them coming and saying they're able to repay it. What are the profit margins on these cryptocurrencies?
I assume it would go out of business. I mean, right. Even if they have some profit, I don't know Upbit. I don't know how old they are. Yeah, it must be something like insurance.
Because you would think they'd probably have to have some sort of insurance being basically a bank.
Although that's an interesting insurer to take risks on things like cryptocurrency.
Yeah, especially since it is pretty, I mean, it is still new.
It's very new. There's very little backing it too, so they don't know what the value of it may ever be up or down. So as an insurer, it's hard to make long-term actuaries on that.
Yeah. So anyways, another thing we've already kind of talked about cryptocurrency several times on this podcast. We did throw out a couple terms there just a second ago, hot wallet versus cold wallet. For those who have not listened to every single episode of this wonderful podcast, the differences between those hot wallets are basically a cryptocurrency wallet, so the public and private keys that are kept on a server so they can easily transfer funds out of that wallet. A cold wallet, on the other hand, is typically those cryptographic keys that are kept on a computer or just paper or something without ever having access to the internet.
And the difference is one is much easier to make quick online payments. I mean, nobody, as much as you should security-wise, nobody wants to, when they want to go to an online site, have to go track down a USB key, enter a bunch of stuff, plug it in and it's much easier to use a hot wallet through an online wallet
provider.
And when
you're the maintainer of an exchange where you basically have to have a balance of coins that you can transfer to other people's accounts at any point during the day, you have to basically have a hot wallet. And it turns out, I mean, clearly 342,000 was a bit too much to keep in that hot wallet that wasn't properly secured. Another thing that we should probably point out is, like, this is a good case where they're paying to refund all that money. There have been so many exchange hacks in the last like 2 years.
Yeah, that's why I reacted to the $50 million. There's been many where even when a company wanted to pay, they had to pay pennies on the cryptocurrency, whatever you call it, pennies on the comparable dollar.
Pennies on the bit.
Yeah, pennies on the bit because they simply couldn't cover the full expense of their losses.
Yeah, so there is quite a bit of risk of keeping your funds in an exchange as a storage tool, basically. Yeah. Like these are wallets that theoretically have access to the internet, which means if someone hacks the server, they could get the wallet and steal all 342,000 coins. So,
as we said before, it's not bad to use them, but you should really manage how much you're willing to put up there. Never share anything with a hot wallet that you're not willing to lose. And if you're making things over $100 in purchase, like I probably would never have more than $100 in a hot wallet, if even. If you want to do $1,000 purchase? Well, I guess that's big enough where you do pull out your cold wallet and take a little bit of time.
I mean, it doesn't take that long to make a transaction, basically. So
surprising how lazy people are. You know, that's exactly why everyone uses their browser or websites to remember credit cards. It doesn't take that long to walk 5 minutes upstairs, grab it, and type the numbers again. But everyone likes the easy button.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do understand human nature, why people tend to just throw it in a hot wallet and forget about it.
But it does come with risks, even like the credit card example you gave. Like sites can get breached and those cards can get stolen. Hopefully they're using encryption most of the time. But as we've seen plenty of times, that's not always the case. So speaking of breaches, our second story might sound like a bit of deja vu. T-Mobile just announced that 1 million of their customers have been affected by a breach where malicious hackers made off with some personal information, including name, billing address, phone number, account number, data rate, plan, and calling features. They discovered this in early November and shut it down immediately.
To be honest, Mark, I'm surprised that we're in December in 2019. So if you told me that it was still, you know, late 2018, I'd totally believe you.
Yeah.
And this just makes it the same.
Basically, this exact same breach happened in late, I think it was August 2018, affecting 2 million customers at the time. Now, obviously, it could have been worse. There wasn't any social security numbers. It wasn't a medical firm. There weren't passwords or credit card details. But having this data in the hands of an attacker is still a risk because they can and probably will use this data either for identity theft or phishing attacks. Like, I'd expect some of the affected customers to get an email from the attacker claiming to be from T-Mobile saying, hey, you've been the victim of a breach. Here's some data to prove that we're T-Mobile. Click this link to reset your password, blah, 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 blah.
Like, it's a pretty common tactic. And vice versa, I would presume T-Mobile's probably ready for this, but just that account number specific to T-Mobile might allow them to do phishing attacks against T-Mobile themselves and have some human support rep reset your password over the phone too, because they can give you enough information, including the account number, to kind of convince you they're that person.
Or like, it could probably even be used to help fuel like a SIM jacking, like SIM cloning thing, where they go in and port over the SIM number, your phone number, to a different SIM card.
And then if you're a T-Mobile user, though, we also have the rate of your call plan, so you can scour and see if other people are getting your plan cheaper and then complain to T-Mobile. So maybe there's a positive little silver lining in this black cloud.
I've not received an email. I'm a T-Mobile customer, but I haven't gotten an email saying whether I'm affected or not yet. I don't know if they've sent them out. But
you should grab the breach and see if any of the rates are interesting.
I do know they come out with like a new plan every year for the exact same thing I already have, and it like goes up or down by $5 each year. And they're like, oh, you should upgrade to this for this reason. It's cheaper. Oh, but then you lose like your unlimited no data cap thing.
Lovely. Thank you.
Ugh.
I will say Cynical Corey says the rest, like name, billing address, and phone number. Guess what, guys? All that information's out there. You should attempt to protect it, but I actually think it's kind of useless in this day and age.
I mean, there's another breach we're not talking about. Well, I guess we are now. That just happened last week, where it was like a data aggregation firm from like social media profiles. Yeah. They pulled a bunch of data from them and stuck them up in a insecure cloud storage bucket. Yep. And people were able to access that database or whatever it was. And it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't social security numbers, stuff like that, but it was all of your address info, phone numbers, basically anything you might have put on a social media platform for, I don't remember the exact number of people, but it was a large number of people. Yep. So yeah, that data is already out there. I don't think you're being cynical, you're being practical. The next news story is actually a bit of an interesting one, and it's following another trend that we saw over the course of this entire year, basically. So security journalist Brian Krebs wrote this week.
Who's that guy? I never heard of him.
He runs a very popular security blog, Krebs on Security. If you haven't heard of him, he has done a ton. He does a lot of...
I think we've talked about him a million times with Mirai and other things.
Yep. In-depth research into security topics. Anyways, he wrote this week about an ongoing ransomware attack affecting 110 nursing homes across the country.
Leave our grandpas and grandmas alone, guys.
Exactly. As it turns out, these facilities were all using a Wisconsin-based service provider for their IT, internet access, data storage, stuff like that.
An MSP, managed service provider.
And attackers launched an attack using the Ryuk ransomware inside the
Ryuk?
MSP's.
Ryuk? Ryuk? I have no clue.
I'm going to call it Ryuk.
I'm assuming it's Russian based on the threat actors.
Basically, they ran this ransomware inside the MSP's networks. Thank you, Siri. Encrypting all of the data that that company hosted for those different facilities. It affected everything from emails, billing, phone systems, payroll, to health patient records. And they were demanding on the end of this $14 million in exchange for the decryption keys, which the owner of the MSP firm says they simply cannot afford to pay. That's a ton of money.
I don't know. I have that in, I think, the backseat of my car. I just got to push into those cushions a little.
I mean, WannaCry required, like, they were asking for like $200 or $300 in Bitcoin.
And I think total, they only made, with all the 400,000 infections, under 200 or right around 250,000.
Yeah.
It's a huge amount, but it's not a surprise for these targeted attacks. I mean, in these targeted attacks, they're picking very specific types of victims: healthcare, government, industrial control. Victims that need the data that's being protected. And it's also not like that the WannaCry, those opportunistic ransomware samples, they infect your computer and they encrypt it right away. I mean, these targeted threat actors tend to have breached networks and probably manually lived on the network for a while. And they're planning out before they actually turn on all the ransomware at once, how the servers are affected. In these MSP cases, they often disable security controls. So there, this is, you know, there might be a chance that you still have a backup left for the kind of opportunistic ransomware, but for these guys have pretty much locked you out. So they want big returns on their work.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Krebs actually pointed out that through a third-party source, he has evidence that this MSP was compromised by both TrickBot and Emotet multiple times as far back as September 2018, and that's usually the way that these attackers deliver this malware. They get into the system first, map it out, find the critical weak points, the database, the backup systems, and like you said, go in and kill all the security protections, the backups, and then run ransomware and then demand a massive ransom payment.
Yeah, I don't love shouting out sometimes our competitors. I guess they're not direct, but CrowdStrike has a great write-up on Ryuk, however you pronounce it.
Ryuk,
it's been around for a while, and you already mentioned TrickBot. TrickBot's well-known banking Trojan, and before this even happened, it was known that TrickBot was a pusher of Ryuk as a secondary payload.
Ryuk.
Whatever the heck it is.
I'm just going to say it a different way every time.
Rook. Ryu.
Ryuk. Ryuk.
By the way, the threat actor that CrowdStrike calls the people behind this particular ransomware are Wizard Spider.
Wizard Spider.
Yep. Russian threat actors called Wizard Spider. Oh, I'm sorry. Wizard Spider was the... No, that's the new one. There's one other spider one that they changed the name. Oh, Grim Spider was the original single actor that they attached to it to, but now it's a group called Wizard Spider.
Why?
I don't have any... I mean, you can... I'll send you the link later. It's their naming is always fun.
That's because they're the ones that name they Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, too,
a lovely
right?
marketing logo for Wizard Spider as well.
That looks like a wizard spider. It's channeling some sort of green... fell energy that I'm assuming
six
is
legs
ransomware.
I guess the two are out of our view in this particular icon.
His hands right there.
Oh, his hands count as legs?
Yeah. That's,
yeah.
Come on.
Well, how'd you deal with the fingers though?
I don't know. I don't even understand why it's called Wizard Spider.
Anyways, if you do want a lot of details, in fact, they go into a lot of detail about some technical injection methods and stuff like that, check out CrowdStrike's post on RYUK. And if you have any systems that take indicators of compromise, they definitely share hashes and other indicators of compromise you can use to just help block this.
So what should MSPs do to make sure that they don't become the next one of these cloud-based management firms that encrypts all of their customers' data?
I mean, we've talked about it. It's kind of hard to know without knowing how they got TrickBot in the first place, but TrickBot's also associated with PowerShell and living off the land techniques. If you remember our past descriptions of MSP attacks that we had a little more inside information on, we eventually learned that they often were stolen credential-based, whether phishing or in some cases kind of stealing via RDP weaknesses. So I do think MFA is one of the big ones. I'd be interested to know if this particular Wisconsin-based MSP had 2FA for their own infrastructure spread widely. We don't have any inside information on this one, so we're not sure. But I think multi-factor is required everywhere if you are a MSP.
And like even on top of that, if you are a managed service provider, even if you aren't a managed security service provider, like if you just do IT with a bit of security on the side, security is still super important for you because you basically have the keys to the kingdom. So on top of MFA, like frequent audits of your network to make sure you aren't exposing like RDP to the internet
exactly.
is super important.
There's lots of, we know that MSPs need more remotely accessible services, but there's millions of ways to secure that. There's access control lists for IPs. There's
VPN.
VPN is the ideal because it's a true authentication and encryption, and you can add MFA to the VPN too. But there's even light ways like our authentication portal where you can at least have a user authenticate before we actually open up a firewall rule. So there's tons of ways you can protect this. The other advice we repeat over and over is, ransomware is among the most up-to-date type of malware when it comes to evasion techniques. You know, it may not be nation state level, but they use some of the latest evasion techniques to get past plain old antivirus or anti-malware solutions. So we've said many times that there are more proactive options like sandboxes, behavioral detection, machine learning that help use those. But this is also where, if you're a small company, you may not have heard of endpoint detection and response, or it might seem weird that you have to have another endpoint agent when you already have antivirus. But endpoint detection response is a type of endpoint solution that's not really there to prevent known malware. That's what your antivirus does. It's there to monitor many aspects of your computer. Yes, files and registry entries are part of it, but also running processes. And it uses many techniques, behavioral methods, heuristics, network-based monitoring to actually try to find if you've been infected. And in some cases, there's specific ransomware protection capability that as, maybe your user does get the ransomware, your security service, your anti-malware didn't block it, but right when it runs, some of these EDR solutions, endpoint detection response, can stop it from actually executing as it's running, preventing the encryption.
Because ransomware has a whole lot of red flags even right at the start, like enumerating a file system, just plain old malicious behaviors like copying itself somewhere, spawning a new child process.
So
if
we
get enough
of
those red flags, you can kill it before it hits anything.
And when I say malware can evade detection systems, I'm thinking of like statically, in that it can change the way it looks as it's landing on your computer. But the one thing it can't change is what it has to do. A ransomware has to do certain things to be effective, and you can look for those things. So all of this, I talked about EDR, but obviously WatchGuard does have something called threat detection response. It is a nice thing to add, even if you have anti-malware, because it gives you things like host ransomware prevention, where it gives you that kind of last Hail Mary opportunity to prevent it from encrypting files, even when it does get on your system.
Yep, and especially with like sophisticated attacks like this one, where it usually starts with a remote access Trojan, like identify, even if you've already been infected with that Trojan, being able to identify it in the month or two before it leads to a massive ransomware attack is really critical. So we've got one more interesting news story that I wanted to bring up. And this one actually involves the court system in the United States. Specifically, Pennsylvania, their high court just ruled this last week that Fifth Amendment rights do apply and prevent law enforcement and the courts from compelling individuals to disclose their passwords.
I think I love the city of love right now.
Is Pennsylvania this?
Isn't it?
Well, Pennsylvania is a state.
So. Or state of love. But why do I remember that? What Tom Hanks movie took place in Pennsylvania?
I have no idea. Anyways, Pennsylvania now joins a few other states, including Indiana, Illinois, and Florida, interestingly enough, in making this ruling. Though there is still no Supreme Court of the United States ruling, so it's really hit or miss across the entire country. The reason I want to talk about this was because, personally, I'm a big privacy dude. I don't want people being able to get into my stuff, even though I haven't done anything wrong. But up until now, and really depending on what state you're in, you can be compelled to give up your password. You can still be compelled to give up your biometric, no matter what, even in Pennsylvania. But there was still a case where a law enforcement officer could like come and demand you unlock your phone with your PIN or whatever password you had. Now, so this ruling actually made a really interesting difference where it focuses on the difference between compelled production of a password versus demanding a key to a locked box, which law enforcement can do. The quote is, "First, the Supreme Court has made and continues to make a distinction between physical production and testimonial production." So basically, if it's something physical, they can demand you give it up to gain access to whatever the system or lockbox or whatever it is. But if it's testimonial, something mental, they can't force you to give it up because of Fifth Amendment rights. I kind of pointed earlier, it doesn't cover production of biometric features. So again, the difference between physical and mental. So you can be forced to give your thumbprint on a thumbprint scanner in order to unlock your phone. But if you're using like Android, or I assume iOS has it, like lockdown modes, you can put it in a mode where even your fingerprint won't unlock it until you re-enter your PIN.
That makes sense to me, by the way. It's always been at least less tested, but it should be illegal to try to compel a password, try to compel you to give information you don't want to because of the Fifth Amendment. But it also makes sense for the biometric, something you are. Police can take your fingerprints. I mean, you're not giving them anything. You don't have to take something out of your mind and give it to them. They just take it because of the authority they have. So it does bug me if you use biometrics as a single factor, of course. Hopefully you're not getting involved in law enforcement. Hopefully you're worried about this because maybe you're going to some state that doesn't have democracy and you're worried about their law enforcement or something. But in any case, for privacy reasons, I like the fact that we don't have to be compelled to share passwords.
So long as you're living in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Illinois, or Florida. I don't actually know what the ruling is in Washington State. I imagine since we're a border state, it's probably a bit more strict because that tends to be the case with Customs and Border Patrol.
Overall, Washington's kind of liberal too, so I feel like Oregon, they lean heavily towards consumer privacy.
Yeah. So actually, you know what? We should look that up at some point. Someone figure that out and tweet at us.
Yeah, tweet at us. And by the way, my weird connective mind was right about Pennsylvania. It's the AIDS movie Tom Hanks was in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Aha.
Which is in Pennsylvania.
There we
obviously.
Go. So you weren't just crazy. You were only
although I got all that insane information. I still haven't looked up the Tom Hanks movie.
Bill Gates, Tom Hanks.
Same difference, right?
Exactly. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, we would love to hear from you. Reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey's at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.
Aloha.
Goodbye.